Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And our engineer just asked me if I was ready, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I can ever be ready enough for the subject matter of today's show. This is really beautiful information that we're going to be talking about, and it's a subject that so many people are familiar with. Consciousness. What is consciousness? And who are we as conscious beings? What's it all about? Is this a conscious universe? To answer those questions is a wonderful author, a book I've been reading, Radical Nature, The Soul of Matter, and he's a professor of philosophy and consciousness studies at John F. Kennedy University and many other credentials, and it's Dr. Christian De Quincey. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. It's very good to be here.
Thank you.
Wonderful conversation.
What's that?
I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Good, yeah, and there are so many questions. I guess the amount of questions is endless because I don't know if we can ever solve so many of these issues about consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly are a student and a teacher of it in amazing ways. Every chapter of your book is just fascinating. And you have a number of books, another one, Consciousness from Zombies to Angels. And those of us who think we fit somewhere in the middle would be appreciating it. So obviously we have a lot of questions to ask you about what is consciousness and how complex or complicated is consciousness itself?
Well, remind me how much time we have.
We only have a half an hour. So we're only going to, touch the surface, but I won't ask you too many questions, but the ones that I ask you, hopefully we can come up with some understanding about, because actually, from my understanding of reading your work, consciousness is actually, in one form, very simple.
Well, exactly. I was just going to say that, in fact, the one thing everybody knows is consciousness. It's the first and most immediate piece of knowledge that we all have. What's difficult is to put into words what we know, is to describe it in language. And even more difficult is to come to some kind of scientific or indeed even philosophical understanding of what consciousness is. And even more challenging is, how does consciousness or the mind relate to the body or the physical universe that we inhabit? Those are the difficult questions, and that's what I address in my work, in my books.
Well, one of the approaches that you take, and it's very interesting, is that I know I'm conscious, but I don't know anyone or anything else is conscious because it's only a pure experience. And I have no idea what your pure experience is, if any, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's in philosophy, that's called the problem of other minds. Everybody is directly and immediately familiar and has knowledge of their own awareness, of their own consciousness. But, for example, right now, for all you know, you could be talking to a computer, a highly skilled or highly trained and programmed computer, or I might be a robot. How can you tell that the person that you're with or the person you're speaking to or any other creature has a mind or consciousness? Well, we tend to rely on gestures like speech and behaviors like visual cues from the face, the eyes, and so on. But those are physical behaviors, and they could be duplicated physically without there being any consciousness present. So we don't have a consciousness meter. There's no meter we can point at somebody that will register whether or not or to what degree and how much consciousness they may or may not have. So how do we know whether anybody else has consciousness? Well, we certainly can't know through using our senses, which is typically the dominant way of knowing in the modern world. We cannot see it, we cannot touch it, we cannot taste it, we cannot hear it, and so on. So how do we know that any other creature, anybody else, is conscious? Well, clearly, if our senses cannot tell us, and it's not something we can figure out rationally, then it means we have to switch to some other way of knowing. And this is what shamans do, for example, and many spiritual practitioners, is they enter what is typically called an altered state. I prefer to call it an alternative state of consciousness. And in an alternative state of consciousness, we can engage in what I call in one of my other books, intersubjective knowing. In this alternative state of consciousness, we have a direct experience that who we are is literally constituted, formed, created by our relationships with others. And in that relationship, recognizing who we are, who I am right now, is partly constituted and created by my relationship with you, even though I can't see you. But by paying attention to my own experience, I can actually, within my, if I was in a particular state of consciousness, have direct experience of the fact that you are a conscious being as well. So there are ways to know whether others have consciousness. And of course, lovers do this all the time, yes? We fall in love with somebody, we don't have any doubt about whether or not the person we're with has consciousness. We experience it directly. We are having a rich intersubjective experience when we fall in love.
But I like the idea, what you were saying, is that our consciousness is also subject to what we see around us, our interrelationship with not only each other, but with the entire world that that we see and feel.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so our experience, our consciousness then boils down to our experience and how much we can divine from our experience of whether it be a normal state or a shamanic state. It's still an experience, and it's only the experience that might be conscious. And what we're really talking about is a mind awareness rather than a consciousness.
Well, of course, we get into the trap or the difficulty of language here.
Yes.
What do we mean by mind? What do we mean by awareness? What do we mean by experience? What do we mean by consciousness? Typically, I use all of those words interchangeably when talking about the relationship between consciousness and the physical universe, or between mind and body. So consciousness, experience, mind, awareness, they're all non-physical, and to that extent, they are the same kind of reality, whereas physical things like mountains and bodies and chairs and rocks and tables and so on, that they occupy space. Consciousness is not something, consciousness or mind or experience is not something that exists in space. One of the ways I have of drawing people's attention to that, when I'm teaching a class, I will often say to my students, point to where you think your consciousness is, or point to where you think your mind is. In the early days, people would point to their head, but more and more people are becoming a little bit more hip to the question. And they would point to their heart. And then the more astute students will do what I call the consciousness wiggle, and they will wave their hands around all of their body as much as to imply that consciousness exists throughout their entire body. Well, I point out that actually it's a trick question. Consciousness doesn't exist anywhere. It doesn't exist in space. It doesn't have that kind of reality. It doesn't exist in your head, it doesn't exist in your heart, it doesn't exist in your body as a physical location.
So what you were asking them was, where does your self-consciousness exist? Or your self-awareness?
Well,
because
then
it's a reference of consciousness, not pure consciousness.
Well, that's very interesting, because then we have the question of where does the self exist? And the same answer would apply. The self doesn't exist anywhere. It's not an object that exists in space. It's not something that we could ever locate or measure. So the non-physical aspect of reality does not exist in space anywhere. So the question, where does self or consciousness or mind, where does it exist, is actually a trick question. The real question to ask is, when does consciousness exist? And, of course, the answer is always now, right now, right now, right now. Consciousness always exists right now in the present moment. And that present moment, as soon as it happens, completes itself and becomes the past. And so what we when we pay attention to that, what we recognize is that the relationship between the mind and the body, between consciousness and the physical world, is actually a relationship in time, not a relationship. It's not like things bumping into each other in space, but it's the relationship between present and past. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, when we think of it this way, and this is called process philosophy, a process metaphysics, when we view the relationship between mind and body through the lens of process philosophy, we see that in relation to consciousness or experience, the body always exists just a moment ago in the past. The body is, in fact, expired experiences that always happen in the moment. As soon as they happen, they complete themselves and they become part of the past.
Right. Anything that you reference takes time, even a fraction of a second, to reference it.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
So anything that we are recognizing, as soon as we bring it into recognition, it's already passed.
Yes. Yes, we cannot observe the observer. Anybody who is familiar with meditation will recognize that statement, is that in meditation, if we try to observe who or what is doing the observing, we find ourselves in an infinite regress that we can never actually pinpoint it.
Now, I have a question.
The eye that sees cannot see itself.
Right, right. The moment of experience is the ultimate awareness, that the pure awareness. But we do have minds that reference constantly. So, as you say, when you talk about consciousness, you're usually not in that pure, only in that pure moment of experience, but in the reference to it.
Yeah, and yes, and now we're getting into, if you like, the content of consciousness. And so an important distinction I like to make is between our thoughts or beliefs and what we actually experience. So another invitation I give to my students is not to believe their beliefs. I open up, I teach a class called Paradigms of Consciousness at John F. Kennedy University, and I open up that course on the first day by saying to my students, I don't want you to believe a word I'm going to say for the next 11 weeks. And typically, they look a little bit surprised to hear that, because they're wondering what they're paying their big bucks for if they don't believe what I'm telling
them. Can you grade them on that?
Well, what I will grade them on is to what extent they can demonstrate that they've understood the point I'm making.
Okay.
I then follow that up by saying, you know what, and I'm not particularly interested in what you believe either. And then their surprise typically turns to a form of shock. That, how can you dare say that to us, that you're not interested in what we believe? And then I say, but you know what, I'm passionately interested in what you experience. What did you feel? What did you experience the moment I said to you, I'm not interested in what you believe? That's what I'm interested in, is what you experienced at that moment. That's where the juice of consciousness is in what we actually experience, not what we think, not what we believe. You see, a belief can be right or wrong, but an experience always is exactly what it is.
So it's not the object of your thought, it's the process.
Yes.
And
yes,
so,
exactly. The process of feeling the experience as it's happening, experiencing our experience in the moment it is happening.
That's like, I often think of relationships that way. It's not so much the mechanics of the relationship, but it's the just the truth of having one, of being in relationship. Is magical in itself, and then there's all the stories around it.
Yeah, we all have our stories. and stories, they're not bad. Stories are actually very interesting. The problem with stories is when we come to believe them. And beliefs aren't bad either. It's believing our beliefs that's when problems arise. We all have beliefs. In fact, we can't help having beliefs. That's what our egoic minds have evolved to do, is to help us develop these shortcuts so we can navigate our way through the world. But the map is not the territory, and the menu is not the meal. We're not going to eat the menu, or we're not going to drive our car onto the map. In the same way, we shouldn't believe our beliefs. We should just notice the beliefs that we have but don't get attached to them. Hold our beliefs lightly, and then be willing to let them go. So
right.
part of the spiritual practice that I engage in is to observe my beliefs and then catch myself if I think my beliefs match reality or that they are reality. So I practice not believing my beliefs, not trying to stop having them. That would be a futile project. But I do have a choice about whether or not I believe my beliefs. I can notice them, I can learn from them, but I don't have to believe them.
And I'm also thinking of the word judgment, that
yes.
we're judging our beliefs. And that's really where, that's the trick, is to get out of that judgment of beliefs. I think that's how we're moving forward consciously on this planet, to be able to surrender more to the experience and not be so judgmental of what we don't really know.
Oh, exactly.
We don't know it anyway. I mean, what we judge in one way turns out to be another thing, and it's always, everything is in flux. And so...
Yeah, so a willingness to live in the mystery is crucial in our times. It always has been. It's even more crucial today.
And
you know, we have so much information swirling around us in our lives through the internet and the World Wide Web, our cell phones and TV, and on and on and on. So there's no shortage of information. We're in an information overload. But information does not add up to wisdom. Wisdom requires stepping back, stepping out of the flux and the flow and the tornado of information that's swirling around us, and actually practice learning to be, to allow more periods of silence in our lives.
And
we
have a
silence deficit in our modern world.
And that comes from trust also.
We need to trust ourselves as well as other people to be comfortable being in silence.
Or trust life, because, you know, we look around us and we see this world imploding on us and wonder, you know, what's going on and how much do I have to go to war to fight for my planet and fight for my civilization. And perhaps it's all finding its way, even though we're still going to do what we're doing. And somehow, if we can trust the process and not get so caught up in our inadequacies and our fears and trust, perhaps it is going to work itself out. And not by itself, but just because everybody is spinning wheels anyway, and life, you know, life goes on in a way that resolves itself eventually. I think that we can all live that way in our own personal lives as well.
We can be sure of one thing. It is all going to work itself out. The big question is it going to, and by it right now, I'm referring to not just our personal lives, but the larger issue of life on this planet, our own species. It is going to work itself out, but the big question is it going to work itself out in a way that will leave the environment, the planet, the ecological system habitable by our species and the other species that we depend on for food and companionship?
But that's
and
also
right now,
a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So you're judging whether we should or not, or could
well,
or not.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Perhaps there's absolutely no requirement that this planet continues to remain a nourishing home for our species. Species come and go. Species do become extinct. And the human species is no exception to that. We are not an eternal species. We're not eternal individuals. We die individually, and we will die collectively at some point. The question then becomes, how do we make the best of life while we have that gift? How do we use our lives for the benefit of other, not just other humans, but of other species as well?
And we can direct that in every level of our lives, in terms of nutrition, in terms of relationships, our careers, whatever. I mean, it's all about wiggling our way through our awareness and understanding. I think it's the perspective between our experience and our judgments, and to be able to hold that objectively. How does that
Yeah. So what is a judgment? A judgment is typically a conceptual, cognitive evaluation of an experience. So rather than getting caught up in our judgments, and I think I hear you saying the same thing, I'm encouraging people to pay far more attention to what we are actually experiencing moment by moment by moment, and not to put too much weight, and at times no weight at all, on what our judgments are. Observe them. Right. We will have judgments, but don't get caught up in them. Don't believe that what we judge to be this way or that way, good or bad, right or wrong, don't get caught up in believing that, because that's just an automatic evaluation that's been programmed into our minds since birth, and perhaps even before birth.
So you're telling your students at the beginning of your classes, you know, don't be programmed by my beliefs.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I'm not interested in giving them new programming. As a teacher, I actually see that my primary role is to deconstruct their programming and encourage them to access their own experience. They don't need me to give them experience. Everybody is having an experience, come what may, from one moment to the next. What tends to happen in our educational system is we are conditioned not to pay attention to our experience, not to actually experience our experience as it's happening. I've tried my little best to counteract that by encouraging people to actually take the time to pay attention to experience their experience as it's happening, and have that be their touchstone to reality, not what they believe or what they think or what they judge.
It's about, you know, understanding how transitory our beliefs are, and maybe if we can have experiences to recognize how beliefs are so driven by external factors that keep changing.
Well, yes, beliefs are transitory, and of course so are experiences. Nothing stays the same ever. Everything is excuse me, everything is always in flux, everything is always changing. And if there is anything unchanging, it is whatever, it's the mystery that knows, that observes the changes. But that itself is not something that, it's not an object, it's not something that we can name or identify. It is what you were referring to earlier as pure awareness of pure consciousness.
And maybe that's why we can do such things in the future as time travel.
Well, now here's an interesting question, time travel. You know, I cannot imagine how that could happen. And just let me give you a little brief example of that, a reason for that, is, first of all, the idea of traveling into the future, to me, is not likely to happen. Because if you think about it, the future doesn't exist. By definition, time is composed of three components. Events that have happened, we call them the past. Events that are happening right now, the present. And events that have yet to happen, we call that the future. But if they have yet to happen, that means they don't yet exist. And something that doesn't exist cannot have any influence on things that do exist. And so the future doesn't exist. It's not something that we can enter into, and it's not something that actually influences us because it doesn't exist. What does exist is the present moment that is rich and bubbling with potential and possibilities that have patterns to them, and a particularly acute state of awareness, we can tap into and read those patterns. We can read the probability patterns of how the present is unfolding into what will become the future. But the actual future itself doesn't exist, so it's not something that we can read or recognize.
Well, then you and I could have a discussion about free will and
yeah.
how our future actually depends on free will or not. And
yes.
if there is no free will, then perhaps the future does exist because we don't have the ability to change it.
Well, I don't know how much more time we have.
We have a few minutes.
Yeah. Choice is crucial. We certainly do have a choice about how the present moment is going to unfold into the next moment, and then the next moment, and the next moment.
Or is that a belief?
Well, it can be a belief, but the belief has no power. What does have power is choice. Choice itself is not a belief.
But
choice is an existential act of an expression from the soul, if you like.
But was your soul always going to make the same choice?
Not necessarily.
Well, we don't know.
If it did, then it would be programmed, and if it were programmed, then it wouldn't be choice. So choice, by definition, is entirely unconstrained, is entirely free.
Okay. I mean, that's a position. You know, it's interesting because I don't know. I'm only making my own suppositions about choice and patterns and how we're embedded in patterns. And even when we make choice, is that a pattern that we just weren't realizing we were making a choice from?
Yeah. Well, if what we take to be a choice is actually determined by some pattern, then I would say that's not a choice.
Right.
It's actually determined by something else.
Right. And that's...
Go ahead.
Well, that's the position that I see, is that there are these patterns unfolding that are larger than our consciousness, or our awareness, let's put it, and we're in it. And I think the planet is unfolding in the way that makes sense, in you know, not even, not necessarily a nice way at this time, but I think eventually to be nice. But, I believe we're all in it and part of a program. And we're just acting it out as, let's say, you know, as God, or put it that way. You know, we are all the creation, and we're creating something.
Well, yes. We are all co-creators.
Exactly.
Participating in the unfolding.
Exactly.
And to that extent, or in that way, we are all sparks of the divine. And the big question is, the $64 trillion question is, who is making the choice? Who am I?
That's perfect, you know. And you know, there's so much more that, you know, this is such a juicy topic, because so many people are talking about expanding consciousness. And what does expanding consciousness mean? And where are we going as a civilization into some new age or some higher dimensionality? And what does that mean in terms of our consciousness? And does it change anything? So
the expanding consciousness would be cultivating what I call our four gifts of knowing, which is the scientist's gift of the senses, the philosopher's gift of language and reason, the shaman's gift of participatory feeling and alternative states of consciousness, and the mystic's gift of intuition accessed in sacred silence.
And so what's your choice of your own expansion of your consciousness?
It is to cultivate these four, every one of us has these four gifts of knowing. And only two of them, the senses and reason, are part of our educational system and are valued in modern society. We need to also honor and cultivate and integrate the shaman's gift of feeling and alternative states of consciousness and the mystic's gift of intuition and sacred silence. And so my choice is to cultivate all of the gifts that I have and then to integrate them and to learn when it's appropriate to apply which particular mode of knowing in which circumstance. So there are times when it's useful to use my reasoning faculties and my language faculties, as I'm doing right now in this conversation with you. There are definitely times when it's very useful for me to use my senses. There are also times when the most dominant mode of knowing is my feeling. For example, if I'm in a relationship with somebody that I deeply care about, then it's a time for me to cultivate my ability to feel deeply. And then there are other times when what's most appropriate, if I want to engage with the deepest questions of the mystery of life and the universe, to enter the mystic's gift of silence and just be without thought, without any concept and just be with what is.
So that's a great path, and an awareness, and actually the response, it's being responsible on all levels, on all dimensions.
Yes, it is. Yes.
And I think as we talk about consciousness in life, we really, you know, it's like the wholeness of reality that we can experience. But I think what you were saying earlier is an important essence of expanding consciousness is to see it from a larger vantage point that's non-judgmental, that where you teach not to believe so much and to trust.
Yeah.
So thank you. Christian DeQuincy, this has been so wonderful to talk with you. How can people reach you?
They can get me at deepspirit.com or thewisdomacademy.org.
And what was the first one again?
Deepspirit.com.
Deepspirit.com or wisdomacademy.com.
It's the Wisdom Academy.
Oh, thewisdomacademy.org. Right.
Yeah.
Christian DeQuincy, author of Radical Nature, The Soul of Matter, and Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, and other books as well. This is wonderful. Thank you so much for all the work you're doing and the consciousness that you're putting into it. Thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And thank you so much for listening.